Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A significant contingent of the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6 included people with a military background, from active duty personnel to veterans. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has called for a military-wide stand down to address extremism, and during his confirmation hearings in January, he pledged to confront the issue head on.
The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
Missy Ryan is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. She's been following the story. Welcome to the show, Missy.
Thank you.
All right. So he's described as taking a hard stance against extremism in military ranks. But ultimately, how much can leadership really do?
Yeah, it's interesting because he has really identified leadership as a primary means for addressing this challenge, but we don't really know what that will entail. Right now, they're at the stage of trying to understand the scope of the problem, and it's been very striking as sort of scrutiny intensifies around this subject in a renewed way. It's been very striking to see the extent to which the Department of Defense doesn't even really understand the scope of the problem. We know that for decades, there have been isolated incidents involving far-right extremists, white supremacists, neo-Nazis at different moments in time in the U.S. military. And we know it's a fairly small phenomenon. It's certainly less significant than the broader plagues of racial discrimination and sexual assault and harassment in the military, but we just don't have any good numbers. And that really is sort of the first order of business for Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin as he comes in. They're launching a review. And I think what you're going to see at the end of this is a sort of more centralized, cohesive effort to track, identify, and potentially consider changing some problematic rules and regulations around membership and affiliation with some of these groups.
Now, right now, they ban so-called active membership, that somebody can't be recruiting for the Proud Boys, they can't be raising money for them and that kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, this is a setup that the leadership is going to be taking a really hard look at. Right now, under the military rules, service members are allowed to be so-called passive members in some of these organizations, but they aren't allowed to do things like fundraise or attend training or, you know, distribute propaganda material. And that's really based in, you know, this very delicate balance that the officials have felt like they needed to strike in the past related to the First Amendment rights of service members. And, you know, you can't control people's ideologies and beliefs as long as they don't cross a certain threshold. And so that's been a difficult balance to strike. And you've seen where it's led to people being able to stay in the military, even as they profess support for some of these problematic organizations. So that's something that I think it is a potential change in the future.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about extremism in the military today. What spurred the conversation is the revelations that fully 14% of those suspects identified so far in the January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol have been identified as with military or policing connections. My guest right now is Missy Ryan. She is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. If you have a question or comment coming up, we're going to have historians on. We are going to have military experts on to talk about this. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I know what stand down means, that they kind of stop regular business to do something, and different kind of military operations stand down for all different kinds of reasons, for holidays, for funerals, you know, whatever. But they're talking about a military-wide stand down. What does that say to you? What is that going to look like, Missy?
Yeah, so what Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued an order for was this military-wide stand down over the next few months. And basically that means that every military unit will find a time, basically a full day, to set aside their normal training operations, their other regular operations, and have an extended conversation about the support for the prevalence of support for these far right organizations in the ranks. And basically, you know, it does serve a practical purpose in that it'll be an opportunity to focus on this issue and for commanders to sort of walk through, hey, these are the rules, this is what you guys need to know about it, but also to hear from service members in a way that can produce feedback that will then be channeled up the ranks and I think inform ultimate policy decisions. You know, it's often, you know, the troops don't necessarily make their commanders aware of what they're seeing if it seems like it doesn't cross a certain threshold. And so I think that there may be more problematic activity that troops are observing than the commanders are aware of. And so it's also supposed to serve that purpose. But, you know, broadly speaking, it really just is a symbol of the seriousness with which the current leadership is taking the issue, this issue. You know, it's very unusual to do this. And so basically what they're doing is they're saying, you know, hey, we want everybody to stress that this is a problem we're not going to tolerate, even in small numbers. And it is just telegraphing that to the whole force.
What about at the congressional level? Are they talking about doing anything?
Well, there have been a number of discussions with Congress over the past, I'd say, 2 years, as we've seen a broader societal rise in support for some of these groups, or at least, you know, them becoming more high profile.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear from lawmakers this sort of, they're sort of also shocked that some of these rules exist, like we just discussed about the fact that the military allows people to be passive members of some of these organizations. And there have been a few congressional proposals to do things like, you know, create a special deputy inspector general at the military to look at some of these issues. There have been some other proposals that haven't advanced, but I am certain that this is going to be something that will be the focus of future legislation. Luckily, there's an annual defense authorization bill that often is a vehicle for these kind of policy changes. And I definitely think that there's going to be an attempt by Congress, probably in consultation with the military leadership, to do have sort of more teeth around this issue.
I'm sure you've read, you're aware of the fact that some of these groups, these extremist groups, actually recruit people from the military and encourage their members to join the military to get skills.
Yeah, I mean, the military is obviously an attractive recruiting pool for, you know, current members, but to a greater extent, veterans are an attractive recruiting pool for some of these groups. The military teaches people, you know, tactics and weapon skills that may be useful. And, you know, we don't know that much about how significant a phenomenon that is, and that's going to be one of the things they're trying to look at in conjunction with law enforcement. But it certainly, you know, that's one of the reasons why the January 6th Capitol riot was such a wake up call, because you did see not only the prevalence of people with military backgrounds in what occurred, but also, you know, we've seen very clear reporting that some of those people were relying on the tactical skills that they acquired in the military to take part in what went down on Capitol Hill that day.
About 1 month before the insurrection, lawmakers removed a provision from the annual Pentagon policy bill, I guess, that would have explicitly made violent extremism a crime in the military code of justice. This was done to avoid a veto by then President Trump. What happened with that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think you'll see come up again. I mean, some of the military prosecutors and the sort of law enforcement apparatus within the military will say, we already have this. It's not necessary. You know, if people are, there are already crimes that are codified that would capture this behavior. So it could be just a sort of more symbolic move. I think that certainly that's one thing that will be examined. You're also another issue that could be the subject of either policy change at the Pentagon or future legislation would be strengthening rules around examining social media of recruits and of active service members. You know, sometimes those things are examined and they have certain authorities to look into that, but they're not routinely scrutinized. For some, there are some, you know, legal constraints around looking at people's social media. And there's also just the sort of logistical challenge of how do you do that and what resources do you devote to that? So that's going to be another subject of, you know, congressional review, I think.
Is there any evidence that there have been complaints from within the ranks about people who get involved in extremist organizations that maybe are not being that are maybe being ignored or set aside?
Well, we don't. That's, you know, it's a good question. And we don't know that much about the extent to which those kinds of complaints are not acted upon. What we do know is that with white supremacist organizations, for example, the investigatory arms of the different military services, so, you know, the CID for the Army and OSI for the Air Force, they say that many of the criminal investigations that they initiate are the result of referrals and complaints from other people in the military. So it does, people do make complaints, and sometimes that results in a criminal investigation. And sometimes it results in administrative action. So that could be, if it doesn't meet the criminal threshold, you know, somebody could get a letter of reprimand, they could get a talking to or a reduction in rank or something like that. So all of these things are going to be in play, I think, in the future.
And I was interested when I was reading about that they don't really keep track of those sort of lower level talking tos, letters of reprimand,
right,
and that kind of a thing.
They don't. And, you know, the people I talk to say, you know, they have never been asked to do that. And, you know, I certainly think that is going to be a requirement in the future, because, you know, this is one of the reasons why nobody really understands how big a problem this is.
How, you know, given the nature of the military and the echelons within it, how in touch do you think the top brass are with what's going down in the rank and file?
You know, it's I think it's a problem. You know, it was interesting because Secretary Austin brought up an incident during his confirmation hearing. He brought up an incident that occurred when he was a lieutenant colonel at Fort Bragg in the 1990s, where there was a double murder by a neo-Nazi cell in this elite 82nd Airborne, the very famous division. And one of the things he said was his takeaways was that, you know, the leadership didn't know. There were signs that people didn't really detect, or they didn't really understand. And I think that there are many instances in which, you know, people come into the military with different backgrounds, with different political beliefs. And, you know, that in some ways, that's the beauty of the military. But at the same time, there is sort of a culture of like, if you don't bring this into the workplace, you know, you can think what you want. And sometimes that becomes a problem when that, you know, is a, you know, hateful or violent ideology.
If somebody enlists and a recruiting officer sees that they have a swastika tattooed on their arm, is that a reason to deny them the opportunity to enlist?
Yeah, that would definitely be a reason. And okay, they do have, you know, binders of tattoos that, you know, if somebody walks into an Army recruiting office that they'll check, and they do reviews of tattoos. But the problem is that, you know, number one, that a lot of people just wouldn't have a tattoo. They might be part of an organization that, you know, they just don't have anything like that. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a new organization with some sort of new tattoo, and there isn't a very effective military-wide updated database for those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue. But I think, you know, the bigger problem is that these kind of things, especially now, are often just online. You know, there aren't visible symbols. It's sort of this online activity that potentially could erupt into something in the real world, but it's hard to detect before that.
Well, Missy Ryan, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Missy Ryan is a national security reporter for The Washington Post, and she's been covering the issue of extremism in the military ranks. We're going to dig a little bit deeper with some experts coming up. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A significant contingent of the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6 included people with a military background, from active duty personnel to veterans. Evidence suggests an extremism in the military ranks is a growing problem. A 2019 Military Times survey found that more than a third of active duty readers who were polled and observed had observed evidence of white supremacist and racist ideologies in the military. We're talking about the history of extremism in the military and strategies for rooting it out. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Peter Mansour is the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State. He came to OSU in 2008 after a 26-year career in the U.S. Army. It included two combat tours in Iraq, and it culminated in his service as Executive Officer to General David Petraeus during the surge of 2007-2008. Welcome back, Peter Mansour.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be on again.
George Reed is Dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. He served for 27 years as a military police officer and was a criminal investigation supervisor at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. George Reed, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And Michael Jensen is a senior researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland, where he leads a team on domestic radicalization. Welcome to the show, Michael Jensen.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Your group, Michael Jensen, has researched trends among people arrested for ideologically motivated crimes. So how often are these perpetrated by people with military experience?
So we've reviewed about 2,200 cases of individuals in the United States that have radicalized to the point of engaging in some type of illegal behavior on behalf of their beliefs. And what we found is that we were able to verify one way or the other in the military service backgrounds for over 1,500 of those individuals. And of those, about 239 of them had military backgrounds. The vast majority of those individuals radicalized after they had already left the military, but it was about 15% of our sample that had some background military experience.
Is there something, and I'm interested, George Reed, in your thoughts on this and anybody else, about the military that either radicalizes or primes somebody to be radicalized post-active duty? George Reed?
The short answer is I don't think so. The fact is that these incidents within the military, certainly by active duty soldiers more than veterans, they are infrequent. But the impact of those infrequent occurrences is outsized. It goes right to the heart of military readiness and teams, and it has negative impacts on recruiting and has a negative impact on overall society's faith and confidence in the United States military, because they are abhorrent. They are not commonplace.
Yeah. Pete Mansour.
Yeah. Well, I would also say that with a certain segment of young men and women who get out of the military, they look for a sense of belonging. And if you're an unemployed veteran and you go back to your hometown and, you fall into a group that's going to give you a sense of purpose in the world, and gives you a pseudo military lifestyle, these militias. And so I can see how some veterans might be caught up and recruited by these organizations and then fall into their ideology.
You know, George Reed, Michael Jensen, you guys study this, and yet the and I know Pete Mansour, you know, you're a military historian, you're fully aware of the trends. But when we hear from top brass in the military, they say, wow, we just didn't know. This caught us by surprise. Where's the disconnect, Pete Mansour, in all of that? How are they so removed from these kinds of activities?
Well, the activities tend to be underground. They occur on social media. They occur in small groups. And, you know, the military doesn't sit there and monitor their soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines 24/7. And so these groups exist. We know they exist. They've existed, you know, since really the end of the Civil War and the formation of the KKK. The extremism and the military have a long history. Again, like George said, it's a very small part of the force, but it's there. The military is a reflection of American society. American society is in part racist. So the military is going to be in part racist. And I would note that extremism isn't just right-wing nationalists. Remember in 2009, you had Major Hassan Nadal, or Nadal Hassan at Fort Hood, who ended up shooting a number of people for his Islamic beliefs. Mm-hmm. So there are extremist groups in the military, and it's very difficult for the leadership to root them out.
Can what kind of... It's difficult to root them out when you find them, but what kind of power does the military really have to, if somebody hasn't acted on it, to change that? Michael Jensen?
Yeah, my understanding is that the Uniform Code of Military Justice gives the military an awful lot of power to do what they want in terms of removing individuals. It's a much lower bar than criminal activity. So individuals associating with known extremist groups or spreading those beliefs can be removed from the ranks.
Yeah. Would George Reed?
Yes, there's lots of tools the military has to deal with this issue. In the wake of the 1995 double homicide in Fayetteville, North Carolina, by these soldiers assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division. In the course of investigating that murder, 22 soldiers were identified as being part of a neo-Nazi racist subculture. Those were mostly dealt with through administrative processes. But here's the thing, we put an inordinate amount of responsibility on commanders and young non-commissioned officers to recognize extremism and to do those administrative things. And sometimes they don't recognize the signs. In every case that I'm aware of, there were plenty of indicators that there was an extremist issue, but those were either not observed, or if they were observed, they weren't recognized, or if they were recognized, they were not acted upon.
Is there any particular training, Peter Mansour, that officers go through to address these issues?
There will be. Because Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin just called for a 60-day stand down and training on that issue, mm-hmm. which tells me that there has not been. And I know when I was in, there was no training. There was training on Army values, right? You want people to be courageous and loyal and so forth, but it didn't specifically discuss extremism. Don't be a neo-Nazi, right? Mm-hmm. Don't shoot your fellow service members over your ideological beliefs. That's going to change. I think what we saw with the insurrection on Capitol Hill is extremism in society is increasing, and and that means that extremism in the military is going to increase as well. And you're going to get to a situation where, say, the military and recruiters are going to have to access people's social media. But that, you know, that's easy. It's easy to hide your social media accounts. Mm-hmm. So it's not a panacea.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is OSU military history professor Peter Mansour. Also with us, Michael Jensen. He's a senior researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. And also George Reed. He's dean at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. We're talking about extremism in the military, whatever flavor you like. We're talking about what obligation the military has. The Secretary of Defense has called for a stand down to address the issue post January 6th, when there were insurrectionists took over for a while the U.S. Capitol. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. I'm interested in the coming at it from a different way, Michael Jensen and the rest, and that is the fact that some of these extremist groups, if not all of them, recruit from the military or encourage their members to get into the military or recruit from veterans of the military. Michael Jensen?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. So if you take a group like the Oath Keepers, for example, this is a group that is formed by military veterans, ex-law enforcement, and ex-first responders. And so these groups really value the skill set that veterans bring to the table. These are individuals that understand weapons, they understand tactical maneuvering, they understand how to organize a fighting force. And these groups, you know, largely don't possess this knowledge. And so the best way to get it is to recruit somebody with those skills. And so we do see them reaching out to veterans more often than they would reach out to the everyday person because of that set of skills they bring to the group.
It appeared to be on quite chilling display, George Reed, on January 6th, from the video that at least I've seen and many others have seen.
Yes, indeed. You know, the veterans are in some respects a different group than the active duty soldiers, although there was some active duty representation in that group.
Yeah.
When it comes to approaches to active duty soldiers, or the allegation that every watchdog group I know has is that these groups are sending people into the military to get trained and then come back to the group and bring that experience, I have to tell you that's awfully hard to find in practice from inside the Army. I know because we looked. And the Criminal Investigation Command, we were looking for those sorts of things. But many of those approaches can be very subtle, and there's certainly no incentive on the part of those groups to be very public because they would be barred from the installations.
Hmm. How big of a deal, Peter Mansour, is this stand down? Is it mostly symbolic? I mean, I'm trying to get a fix on how really big of a deal this is, or if this is just window dressing, or if they really want to do something. But how much is a stand down and a talking about it for a couple of days going to matter?
Well, you can't train your way out of this issue. These are sometimes long held beliefs that people bring with them into the military and take out back into civilian life with them as well. But you can increase awareness. So you can create an environment where others in the military notice the signs, notice their buddy or notice groups and then can raise a red flag if they notice something that is extremist behavior. So I think in this sense, the training can be valuable, but we shouldn't expect to be able to change deeply held beliefs among service members, because a one day training session just isn't going to do that.
I'm sure it's not lost on any of you that another big recruiting ground for extremists is our U.S. prison system. Again, the same kind of sort of militaristic setup there as well. Structure, isolation, sometimes. George Reed, is there a parallel to be drawn there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the Bureau of Prisons has the most comprehensive repository of tattoos and symbols that are observed in the prison system. And of course, they make that available to law enforcement for reference. So yes, prisons can be recruiting grounds. They're fertile recruiting grounds for extremism, and something we haven't really talked about, but gang affiliation as well. Military affiliated gang members, in some respects, is a larger issue than the racial and ethnic extremist issue. It just doesn't shock the conscience as much as the racial and extremist issue does, because that sits on a social fault line.
What are the natures of the gangs, do we know?
Widely varied, but there are nationwide gangs that are out there in significant numbers. Many of them are neighborhood oriented, but they tend to profligate in the prison system. And a lot of soldiers come into the military with perhaps trying to get away from some of that. And so they may have been affiliated in the past, looking for a new future. And that's an honorable thing, of course.
You know, I know that, Peter Mansour, you came up through West Point. What about the military schools? How do they, are they, is this something that they address?
Well, not explicitly, but in discussing duty, honor, country at West Point, for instance, you can't help but, you know, be imbued with a spirit that joining a neo-Nazi gang is not the right thing to do.
Right.
So, I think we do a much better job in the pre-commissioning phase in the military academies and probably ROTC as well. But a lot of the extremist activity is in the enlisted ranks. And of course, they don't get that extensive experience before enlistment.
Hmm. George Reed, I wondered if you could share more of the details of that double homicide case that you worked on at Fort Bragg. What happened? What instigated it? What you and more about the quite, I would think, is a large cadre of people involved.
You know, that case was a turning point and a point of introspection. It was extremely painful for the United States Army and indeed the Department of Defense. What happened was three soldiers assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, white soldiers, decided to go off into the community one evening and perpetrate an act of violence against a minority group. Their first idea was to do damage to a synagogue, but they couldn't find it. So they went driving around after drinking copious amounts of alcohol, I might add, and found an African-American couple walking down the street. Two of the soldiers got out of the vehicle. One remained, the driver, and the driver heard multiple gunshots. And he said to himself, oh, my God, they actually did it. And he drove off. The two soldiers had killed this couple who was doing nothing but walking down the street. And then they went back to an off-post location. The driver came back around, perhaps feeling guilty or being afraid of what had happened, and was confronted by the Fayetteville Police Department. He subsequently told everything. So it wasn't a difficult case mm-hmm. to crack, if you will, from an investigative standpoint. But in the course of subsequent searches, there was a lot of racist material at their off-post residence. And they, in retrospect, they became radicalized, if you will, in about a 9-month period. They went from having some views and finding each other and reinforcing those views to perpetrating an act of homicide in a 9-month period. And they were not a member of any specific hate group. They were just influenced by the ideology.
We're going to continue our conversation. That is George Reed. He's dean at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Also with us, Michael Jensen. He's a senior researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. And OSU military history professor Peter Mansour. Questions or comments about extremism in the military, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about extremism in the ranks of the U.S. military and among military veterans. Still with us, retired U.S. Army Colonel and the General Raymond D. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State, Peter Mansour, retired Army Colonel and military policeman and Dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, George Reed, and senior researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland, Michael Jensen. You have a question or comment? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. George Reed, you're quoted as saying that extremists in the ranks present a mortal threat to civil-military relations. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that the impact when we have racial and ethnic extremism in an organization that's sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States to include the Bill of Rights, that goes to the relationship with the people at large. People begin to question the motives of the United States military, the fidelity of the United States military, and that's very problematic from a civil-military relations standpoint. A metric of great importance, that should be of great importance to every senior leader of the United States military, is the faith and confidence of the American people. And when these incidents happen, that confidence is shaken.
Michael Jensen, your research has shown that far-right extremists in the U.S. tend to radicalize later in life than far-left extremists or Islamist extremists, that kind of thing. What do we know about why that is?
We know that there's multiple contributing factors that might explain why older individuals are attracted to far-right extremism. A lot of the narratives that are pushed by far-right extremist groups are ones that are targeting older individuals. They're grievance narratives that are based on individuals not realizing their expectations in their careers and their families and in their communities. And so they're targeting individuals that are a bit more advanced in life that should have achieved certain goals that they haven't achieved. And the narrative tells them that their failure to achieve those goals is not their fault. It's because there is a conspiracy undermining their ability to achieve those goals. So that's one reason. Another reason is that one that we've already mentioned is that these groups often look to recruit older individuals that bring a set of skills to the group that younger people just often don't have.
And that's not the case for left-leaning groups or Islamists. They tend to really go after younger people.
Yeah, you know, Islamist groups, for example, have really preyed on young people by playing up the thrill and adventure angle of extremism. So the Islamic State's main motivating tool for getting individuals to travel to Syria and Iraq was to present it almost as a video game, somewhere where you would go, where you'd be in an exciting adventure, and you would get lots of personal material rewards from your participation. And it was a narrative that was specifically targeted to teenagers and young adults.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Peter Mansour, I'm interested as with your background in the armed forces, what was your reaction to the Capitol attack? When you saw those videos, were you seeing patterns that made sense to you?
It had my blood boiling. And there was clearly organization behind it. You could see in one case a file of men moving up the Capitol steps in what's called a ranger file with their hands on each other's shoulders as they're moving up. There was clearly training and organization behind it. And, I was just incensed as an American to see the Capitol under attack like this.
Evidence that there are military types in that group, it just for civilian type people, it's scary to see that. And I think, George Reed, that's kind of what you're talking about, that relationship between military and civilian thing. We need to trust each other. Yeah.
First, I'd like to point out that, it's not evident who's a veteran.
Right.
There's a lot of people with pseudo military training in militias. Who try to pass themselves off as patriots and as military personnel, and they may not have a day in the military in their lives, so we need to be careful about painting the military with such a broad brush. But the statistics are there. 30 people with military backgrounds and three more who were active duty reservists or National Guard who were in the rebellion. So we can't take this lightly.
Right. The percentage wise, it's about double what the incidence is in the general population. Right. Let's see.
Actually triple, because it was 20% versus, I think, 7% of Americans are veterans.
You're right. Jason in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jason.
Yeah, you pretty well covered the first one. That 14% seems to be about a good cross-section of the American population as a whole, as far as members of the military or police, you know, or ex-members. But the question is, and my wife, I was married to her, she's a 22-year retired veteran of the security police, Air Force security police. And it seems that the military in general, combat arms in particular, and police in particular, attracts a certain type of individual with a certain psychology that is much more to the right and much more militant in their overall thinking. And then that military kind of, especially the military police and the police in general, kind of reinforces that. The uniform and the badge gives them power. They're armed when nobody else is. And it's very attractive to a certain psychological set.
Michael Jensen, is that what your research shows?
To some extent, but I do think it is important to highlight that individuals from, you know, multiple political leanings can be recruited into the military, and they serve bravely. But certainly recruitment does tend to focus in areas of the country where there are more conservative political viewpoints. But when we're talking about the psychology of an individual that joins the military, I actually think that the overriding characteristic that matters here is that these are individuals that want to lead. Right, they want to, they want to have a sense of purpose in what they're doing, and so they have leadership qualities, they have leadership ambitions, and as we've already talked about, when they leave the ranks, if they're not able to replicate that leadership in their civilian lives, that can open up a window for some troubling developments.
And the geographic locations of most of the recruiting, Peter Mansour, you think makes a difference?
Well, it does. A lot of the recruiting is in the South and the Northwest, and I don't think it's any surprise that in the mid-1990s, you had incidents at Fort Bragg of neo-Nazis. There was a 2006 study that found hundreds of extremists at Fort Lewis, Washington. And so, again, the military is a reflection of society, and if it's recruited from a societal base that tends to be more conservative, then you're going to have a small percentage that are on the extreme edge of what that means, at least to them.
And can you really, George Reed, screen that out at the outset? The seed's been planted, but maybe it's not necessarily flourishing at the point of recruitment.
I think everyone who studies this issue points to additional screening as something that would help. I am circumspect, however, about the ability of military recruiters to identify belief systems that individuals have. They can do background checks. They can do criminal history checks. All of that may or may not indicate an issue. But when we're talking about ideologies, we can't get in people's heads and find out what they think. It's rather irrelevant. What matters is what they do. So we have to focus on behavior, statements, internet activity, and those sorts of indicators in order to take action on extremism.
I mean,
and that's usually going to require someone's fellow soldier to rat on them, basically, mm-hmm. because the commanders just can't be on everyone's social media page.
Right. But what about the ratting on somebody? That's not necessarily encouraged either, is it? Just by the nature of the military, Pete?
Well, it will be after the 60-day stand down. See, this is the whole point, I think, of this stand down.
Yeah.
You know, if you see something, say something, and you just can't allow this sort of stuff to slide by as, you know, Joe being Joe.
Hmm. Let's see. Chaz in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chaz.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you, gentlemen. I have a question about the security clearance process. Could we add something to the security clearance process that would give the FBI access to their database in order to root out extremism?
Well, the getting a secret or a top secret clearance, those things are already open to investigators. The fact is that most soldiers don't have security clearances, especially the junior enlisted ranks. They just don't. They have no need for it unless they're in perhaps the intelligence field. So I don't think that's just it's not a panacea.
And Michael Jensen, what does your research tell us about how far up the ranks this necessarily goes? Is it pretty confined at this point to the lower ranks?
For the most part, yes. Most of the individuals that have gotten caught up in this have been lower ranked individuals. There have been, stories that the lower rank individuals might be particularly susceptible to this type of recruitment or radicalization when they fail to meet their ambitions in terms of their rank within the military. So there have been cases of individuals that were denied spots and special forces and things of that nature. And that really started their pathway of radicalization because they had a grievance about how they were treated in the military. So yes, this does seem to be a phenomenon that's primarily isolated at the lower ranks.
And what about people in the military, people in the ranks that may be more sensitive, people, African-Americans, people of color, people, gays, LGBTQ, all of that, George Reed, is there, by liberalizing the military such as it has been, could that help or hurt, or could it change the trajectory?
Well, there is a dynamic that we've observed in looking at this within the military, and that is that the people that are likely to see extremism or to have an extremist event are going to be lower enlisted minority soldiers. They are, in many respects, are attuned, they are sensitized, and they will see things that others do not see. The last person in the United States military that will observe an incident of extremism is someone like me, a white colonel. Very high up in the organizational structure and very unlikely to come across an extremist expression or some sort of confrontation. So it tends to be experienced by lower ranking minority soldiers.
I'm kind of throwing this out to all three of you, is the idea of using, for lack of a better word off the top of my head, spies, people to investigate, maybe from a military police point of view, Michael Jensen?
I think that those things can happen when there's suspicions of criminal activity. So the Criminal Investigation Division will get involved and investigate instances where they think crimes are being committed. I think what's happening now, what was actually a requirement of the National Defense Authorization Act, is that a broader survey be put into place, a workplace survey, to try to gauge the scale and scope of the problem. So your rank and file members of the military will now be asked how often they have experienced or come across extremist content, images, language, things of that nature. And what that does is it gives us a sense of how widespread the issue is and where perhaps there might be hot spots of the issue. It doesn't, however, tell us who the extremists are within the military. And so that's where units like the CID and some of the insider threat teams will have to play a larger role in doing more, individualized investigations.
Yeah. Pete Mansour, what about that?
Yeah, that's the same thing the military has done to find out the extent of sexual harassment, widespread surveys, and what they found shocked them, that it's much more widespread than they believed. Because again, like George said, you're a colonel, you're a general, you're not exposed to what's happening down below as much as the people who are down below. And so I think once those surveys come out, we're going to find that extremism's although still a minority of the military is more widespread than we think.
Well, I think after the stand down, it might be definitely worth it to gather again and talk about what happened and maybe what the military might look like post stand down. For now, I want to thank you, Professor Peter Mansour, who holds the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair in Military History at Ohio State. Pete, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Michael Jensen, senior researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. Appreciate your time, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And George Reed, dean at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Thanks again. I really appreciate your insights today.
Thank you, Ann.
That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.